This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll speak with Scott Horton about his new book, Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare.
We'll find out who those dark lords are and how they've gotten us into war after war after war.
We'll take a look at why the United States recently issued new sanctions against Venezuelan government officials.
Question is, who will be sanctioned? The United States or Venezuela?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Bogosian, executive director of the A.J. Mustie Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, how is Julian Assange faring these days, and what's the status of his case?
Well, he's still in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. The three-year anniversary will be June of 2015 this year, but he's been under a custody order from the Swedish courts since 2000. He's been under a custody order from the Swedish courts since late in 2010. He's doing fine in the embassy. What he told me the other day was that there's some 8 million documents now on the WikiLeaks website in a highly searchable form. So that's an incredible accomplishment. And his main interest really is in keeping WikiLeaks going and not having to worry about all the legal swirl around him. He's trying to focus on that more, keeping WikiLeaks going, than on what all of us lawyers are doing to try and get him out of there and get him safe passage to Ecuador.
Now, Michael, I read recently that some of the staff members at WikiLeaks are being monitored. Is there an active government campaign to sort of intimidate and harass those persons?
Yes. Finally disclosed to us about a month or two ago, which I think I spoke about on the show, were the fact that three search warrants had been issued for all the emails on Google of three WikiLeaks associates or people who work with WikiLeaks: Sarah Harrison, Kristen Harafson, and Joseph Farrell. One of the interesting things about those subpoenas, and of course all the material has been turned over to the government, is it, we believe, includes attorney-client material. Because, for example, myself and others were involved in talking to those people as our clients over those years. And so what really happened is Google turned over not just the materials from WikiLeaks employees, but also from all their attorney-client relationships. I'm not blaming Google particularly for that, but the government in particular, of course, now has probably hundreds of our attorney-client emails. We'll give you updates on that as we continue to go along. There's been no decision about what to do about that yet. The main thing that happened in the last day or so since I visited Julian is some developments in his court case. A few months ago, maybe more, he brought a case in Sweden to try and say, look, nothing's happened in my case. I've been sitting in the embassy for 3 years almost. The prosecutor's never come to question me at the embassy. There's only allegations against me. I've never been indicted. You can't just keep a case going forever while you keep me in custody, essentially, in the embassy. If I leave the embassy, I get arrested and go, and I'm forced to go to Sweden. And by doing that, forego my right of asylum, which is my right to go to Ecuador. So he brought a case in Sweden, and he lost through the most of the courts, and now it's in the Supreme Court of Sweden. And just last week, the Supreme Court of Sweden issued an order saying that the prosecutor had to respond to two of our allegations in those legal papers. One is, what is causing the delay in the investigatory procedure? Because a lower court had said that the prosecutor is not carrying out her duty to continue this case. But they said there's no consequences from that, which is hard to believe. So the Supreme Court is looking at that again. And the second thing they asked about is something not familiar to Americans so much, but is the issue of proportionality. There's a point at which, under Swedish and European law, if the consequences of what's happening to you outweighs, from a proportional point of view, the state can't continue what it's doing. And so the court also asks the prosecutor to discuss, why is this proportional, what you're doing? He's been in custody now almost 3 years at the embassy, or in detention, rather, and yet you haven't moved the case forward at all. Now, isn't that disproportional to keep him in detention for 3 years and not move the case at all? So I'm not saying anything's going to happen with the Swedish Supreme Court. They have an incredibly conservative legal system in Sweden. But what is being set up, and what was set up in an incredible set of legal papers filed in Sweden, is a case that can go to the European Court of Human Rights on the fact that Julian Assange is being arbitrarily detained and that the investigation is not proceeding.
And how quickly would it move if it went to the European Court of Human Rights? Would that stagnate for another year or two? Or
it could move relatively quickly on some of the issues. For example, on interim measures, it could move to say that the UK and Sweden are required to give Julian Assange access to a hospital if he needs to leave the embassy and come back without being arrested, or access to the roof for sunshine, because right now he has less sunshine than the minimal standards of the United Nations, which is less than what you're supposed to get, at least an hour a day of exercise outside, and he gets none.
And that applies to detainees universally. What happens if he needs a doctor? Does someone come and visit him now?
Right now a doctor can come in, but if there's an emergency and he has to go to a hospital, the UK has not given him a guarantee of safe passage back and forth, which is a violation of his asylum. It's also a violation of his human rights. But I'm cautiously optimistic about this latest development in Sweden, and I'm perhaps more than cautiously optimistic about what might happen in the European Court of Human Rights, which is where this case will ultimately wind up.
How are his spirits?
Julian's in good spirits. I mean, I think the fact that WikiLeaks has been so successful over the last period is very important to him, in fact, the most important, and he understands he has a long struggle. Now, I should say another development, I meant to mention this, another development that happened while I was gone these last 10 days was there was an opinion in a Freedom of Information Act case with regard to WikiLeaks. An organization we've interviewed on this show, EPIC, had filed a FOIA case to find out what the U.S. government is doing with regard to surveilling WikiLeaks supporters. The federal district court judge denied EPIC's request and wrote an opinion that's quite astonishing, because to the extent that people have said, oh, Julian Assange is just in that embassy because he doesn't want to go to Sweden, this actually points out that he's in that embassy because of what's going to happen to him in the United States. And so the court says we're denying this request under what's called a continuing investigation exemption. There's a continuing investigation of WikiLeaks. The judge said it's a multi-subject investigation of WikiLeaks that has been an enduring investigation going on for a number of years. It does not have to do with the Manning investigation. In other words, Chelsea Manning is the one who allegedly gave the documents to WikiLeaks. And of course, Chelsea has been prosecuted and is serving 35 years in a military prison. But what's interesting is this federal court judge is saying there's this investigation, it's continuing, it's enduring, it's multi-subject, and it does not have to do with Chelsea Manning, which means all of the so-quote naysayers who said Julian Assange is just there because of Sweden, etc., are just dead wrong. Julian Assange is there because the threat of persecution hangs over his head in the United States. And even once Sweden is dealt with, which I think it will be at some period in the foreseeable future, we still are faced with the United States. And that question will be, will the UK honor Julian's right of asylum that he's been given by Ecuador and let him exercise that right by going to Ecuador? In the end, the sword of Damocles is the United States.
A half a century ago, when the United States made war in Vietnam, it was a time when national debates and public discussions engaged America's political consciousness. That's not the case so much these days, says our guest author and attorney Scott Horton. His recently published book, Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Wars, examines how secrecy within the United States government has corrupted fundamental systems of democracy. Scott Horton also surveys the legal authority that the current national security elite have based decisions to torture, wage war, and subcontract private soldiers. When operating in secret, mistakes, excesses, and crimes committed in the process are often kept quiet. Scott joins us today from Washington, D.C.
Scott, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you.
We love your book. Tell our audience, who are the Lords of Secrecy, and does anyone stand out as a particularly high lord?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think High Lord would be the word. I would say the Lord. the Dark Overlord. And the Dark Overlord is Dick Cheney. He gets that distinction not only because he spent most of his career in the intelligence and defense community. You know, he was one of the longest-serving secretaries of defense. But because he had a peculiar attitude about secrecy. So he manipulated and used secrecy all the time to give cover to claims and statements he made that turned out not to be true. And, you know, these claims were frequently matters of the highest consequence. So the entire case to go to war in Iraq, which was in fact led by Dick Cheney, if you go back and remember what was going on in 2002, 2003, rested on claims that they had weapons of mass destruction and that they had aligned themselves and were operating with Al-Qaeda. That's how we got the connection to 9/11. Those claims were very aggressively put forward by Dick Cheney. They turned out to be completely false, and he parried any attempts to challenge them by saying, well, all the intelligence and information we have on that is secret, so I can't share it with you. And, of course, in good time, we learned that there wasn't any intelligence or information that supported these claims. But going beyond that, the Lords of Secrecy consists of the higher echelon officers of the National Intelligence and Security Bureaucracy. And they're the people who have, under American law, the power to create secrets using their classification authority. And I make the case that they use that power very aggressively and very effectively to make themselves the ultimate decision makers on key national security issues and to remove those matters from the democratic political process so that you and I and other citizens don't get to discuss them. Congress isn't even able to deal with them. It's only the Lords of Secrecy who really influence the final decision when it's made by the executive.
In your conclusion, in the epilogue of the book, Scott, you talk about these people and also about the securing of power by the 1%. And it's a combination of the Lords of Secrecy and the top economic elite is what we're afraid of here.
That's exactly right. And in fact, you know, the Lords of Secrecy, the people who wield the classification power, also are part of a revolving door in Washington. So they're in government service. They leave that. They go to work as directors and senior officers of major contractors. Those contractors hold $500 billion in contract business every year, paid for by taxpayers. And they also make enormous campaign donations that strongly influence our political process. And they make huge profits and are extraordinarily wealthy. They are also a sliver of the 1%. And I think one thing that's very, very interesting here, that is over the last 15 years, Washington, D.C. has emerged as the wealthiest standard metropolitan statistical area in the United States. And that's on the strength of the position of contractors and their ability to suck our treasury dry.
Scott, in addition to the privatization issue, can you describe how the role of secrecy in America has accelerated since the advent of nuclear technology?
I would go back. I think maybe it's interesting to go back to the time of the Vietnam War and just think back to those days, the late 1960s and early 1970s, where the country as a whole was really deeply engaged in questions of war and peace, whether the Vietnam War was legitimate. And I say that whether people were in the anti-war movement or whether they supported it. It was a burning issue. It was the leading political issue. It led political debates. It decided elections. And coming out of that process, I think that was viewed by our national security elites as a traumatic time for them, in which their advice and their analysis was disregarded, ridiculed, criticized by large parts of the American public, in fact, by the better educated parts of the American public. And they set out after that to identify what are the flashpoints, what are the points where people become involved, what causes them to engage in these issues, and how do we shut that off? How do we ensure that the public just butts out of these issues so we can decide them? And they took a number of steps. So one of those steps was eliminating the draft. I mean, the draft is clearly was a major motivator that got people wound up and very interested in these matters. They also brought in military contractors to take positions previously held by soldiers. So Americans get very concerned when American citizen soldiers are shot or wounded on the battlefield. But when it's contractors, not really so much. And then they moved to the development of robotic weaponry, which, you know, meant no risk of Americans really being harmed when they're deployed. And when there's no risk of Americans being harmed or deployed, so their thinking goes, the American people have no legitimate say about all of this. And then secrecy is a cloak over all of that. So to the extent that the national security elites can say some contemplated action or strategy is a secret matter, well, the American people are not entitled to know anything about it. And frankly, for the most part, neither is Congress entitled to know anything about it. And what the American people don't know about, they don't form opinions about, they don't cogitate about, they don't become engaged with. So that shows how secrecy and these other steps are really a very potent narcotic against democracy, effectively, causing democracy to just fade away while the national security elites are at the driver's wheel, making all the key decisions.
We're speaking with Scott Horton, author of an incredible new book, Lords of Secrecy. Now, Scott, going back to what you were saying on the three, what you call three factors that really have allowed us to go into wars without the consent of the American people, and on top of that you lay secrecy, which were the volunteer army, drones, and private contractors, and then secrecy. So one of the theses I got out of reading the book is that this is what allows us to basically make unconsented war on the world. Am I right in reading the book that way?
Yeah, I think it allows us to make war without going through the constitutional process. And I use constitutional in a sort of broad sense in that regard. You know, it's really very, very vague about how this go-to-war decision is supposed to be made. You know, there's the appropriation authority of Congress. There's the commander-in-chief power of the executive. There's the power to declare war, and exactly how those rights and powers are to play out in any given situation really isn't clear, and they've been interpreted quite differently, you know, over our 230-year history. But I'd say that what's consistent and clear is that there's supposed to be a process when we engage in sustained hostilities abroad that involves the people, involves the Congress, and involves the executive. It's supposed to be a broadly born decision. And, you know, that's been imperfectly observed through American history, but I'd say until recently it was observed in at least some form. And now we see a really radical new system emerging, and which is just circumvented altogether. That's been on the horizon now for 15 years, roughly, and it's becoming a bigger and bigger problem. And the bottom line is U.S. waging sustained wars overseas without the people of the United States having taken a decision to do so.
Scott, you talk about the fate of the Conyers-Amash bill, which was defeated in Congress, and I think it's important to talk about what that bill tried to do and what happened to it.
Well, the Conyers bill, I mean, it was a pretty simple premise, and it came with Justin Amash and John Conyers saying, hold it now. You know, we're seeing from the Snowden disclosures for the first time that the PRISM, that's PRISM program, which is this broad surveillance program, is something really radically different from what the NSA and other government representatives had told us. It's more sweeping. It does involve all U.S. citizens. Yeah, we were basically lied to, and an appropriate response from Congress right now is just to shut down this program. It's over. We make that decision. So that's the core of that specific proposal put forward by two Michigan congressmen who would be, I would say, on opposite extremes of the political spectrum. So Amash being a Tea Party Republican and Conyers being, I'd say, a traditional sort of even New Deal liberal Democrat. But, you know, both having very much the same views here. And, you know, as they came down to about 48 hours before a vote on it, the White House, Department of Defense, NSA, went into sudden shock because their nose counters told them, you're going to lose. This is going to pass Congress and has a pretty good majority. They then pulled out all the stops. They sent General Alexander to Congress for a day, knocking on doors and lobbying congressmen. They lined up both the Democratic and the Republican leadership in the House to twist arms. The White House itself became involved. And they barely pulled it out so that this amendment was defeated by an extremely narrow margin. The House basically broke right down the middle. And I think one thing that's just fascinating, or I'd say two things that are fascinating about that vote. One is that it showed that this isn't a Democrat versus Republican issue, because actually, if you look at the vote tally, the two parties broke right down the middle. So you had the Libertarian wing of the Republican Party, and you had the civil liberties wing of the Democratic Party bearing the amendment, and you would have what I call more the conservative center of both parties on the other side. And then the second thing that I think was extremely telling is if you take one overlay to this vote, you look at who took money from national security and intelligence contractors. And this was the most reliable predictor of who would vote for or against the amendment. So everyone who took significant money from defense and intelligence contractors voted against.
Yeah, that's a plenty scary thought.
We have a bought and sold Congress. I mean, you know, these interests who rely on, I mean, a lot of them rely very heavily on the NSA for funding and rely on these programs. They put out the word, vote no. And their money definitely translates into votes.
Scott, can you talk briefly about the mainstream media's role in furthering this secrecy?
Yeah, that's a very interesting phenomenon. In fact, you know, my book has gotten, so far, much stronger attention in Europe than it has in the United States. and I've been interviewed recently by British and French reporters, and they all ask this question. I mean, they basically say, we don't understand why the American media doesn't pick up and write about this book. And then one of the British reporters told me recently, you seem to ask questions that they're embarrassed to talk about. And I think, you know, a big part of the problem we have is the way national security and particularly intelligence community matters are reported in the United States. And we have very good reporters and very bad reporters in this area. But, you know, young reporters trying to make their reputation are very, very keen to develop their sources within the community and to use that as a basis for reporting. And you'd think they would look for leakers, and they say that they're looking for leakers, but it's increasingly difficult to identify and work with leakers in the current environment. They've really chilled it dramatically. So, in fact, what they do is work with people who are doing planted leaks. They're putting out messages that the community wants to be out there. And this produces coverage which is far less critical and actually far less objective than you get outside of the United States. So one thing I looked at in my book is I looked at the coverage of the drone war in Pakistan, and I found very clearly that Americans are actually the most poorly informed community globally on this issue. Even though it's a huge matter of importance to them, it's their money that's being spent on it, they actually know much less about how this drone war is being waged than, say, people in Britain or France, or for that matter, even people in Pakistan or India, who have much more direct connections in reporting. And the reason is that the American press is reporting a sort of dumbed-down version of what Obama gets in his briefing in the morning from the CIA. You know, we have a legitimate target. We struck the legitimate target. It was 100% successful. There was no collateral damage. Now, that turns out not to be true an alarmingly large part of the time. And other journals around the world are reporting the fact that it's not true, and they're reporting what they learned from their sources in Pakistan or on the ground. But that doesn't happen so much in the United States. So it's a huge problem.
Scott, following up on that, one of the chapters of your book is around whistleblowers. And what you say about whistleblowers is you call them our last and best hope. Can you explain that and what's happened to whistleblowers under the current president?
Yeah, I go back and I look at this problem of too many secrets and all the pressure that builds up from it, and the and how it sucks the oxygen out of the air for democratic debate. And I look at how social scientists previously have examined this problem, how they've said you will resolve it. And, of course, what they've said is, well, Congress or the legislature will resolve it by having committees of inquiry that will force out necessary information. Now, I would say the people who wrote that don't have much familiarity with legislators and how they operate, because that's a rather naive expectation. Rather, it's the other way around. Legislature becomes involved and deals with things when the expose is already out there in the press, and there's pressure on them to collect information. So you need to get that information out there. So the media plays a key role, but the media can't really act without the whistleblower. So I think we really come down to the whistleblower being the last and best hope. And the only way we can ensure that there is a sufficient amount of meaningful information to provide for informed public discussion of essential policy issues. And, you know, I think the Snowden disclosures are a clear demonstration of that, because public attitudes moved demonstrably following the Snowden disclosures. Once he made clear that, no, the prison program is not what they described to you, it's far more sweeping, and it is very invasive and does affect the position of most Americans and people all over the rest of the world. That's, I think, a key case that shows how whistleblower action can and should work to move the needle on public opinion.
What was your reaction when Snowden said that he was interested in coming back to the United States? I just wanted a fair trial. What do you think will happen to him?
Well, I thought the timing of that was brilliant, in a word. I mean, you know, he makes the statement, or rather his lawyer makes that statement, just as the plea bargain deal is announced with Petraeus. And, of course, I think a lot of people looking at whistleblower prosecutions have been noting that, as I say in my book, that, you know, this whole process seems to be run by the Lords of Secrecy. So they seem to use it to strike out at people who embarrass them publicly. And when figures, powerful figures in the government leak, well, that's, you know, neither here nor there. They don't really care about that. In fact, they seem embarrassed even when these things come up. And so the Petraeus case was a striking one, because Petraeus was responsible for, you know, significant information falling into the hands of people who shouldn't have it. It was something, information he shared with his paramour, who was writing a biography of him. So abusive, but the sort of abuse that occurs all the time. I mean, Bob Woodward has built his career based on that. And I think, you know, the problem is that national security whistleblowers don't get a fair trial. We've seen that for some time now. They wind up being abused, mistreated, the decks are stacked against them. And the question is, you know, whether we could, you know, get some sort of agreement with the Justice Department that would permit Snowden to be treated fairly. And so I think the timing of his request is, you know, brilliantly placed, because, you know, let the Justice Department explain why they decided that Petraeus should get a slap on the fingers, nothing too serious, while they want to throw the book at someone like Snowden. Let them give us the rationale for their distinction between these cases. They've never done that.
Scott, what do you recommend should happen to the Central Intelligence Agency?
Very good question. I was yesterday at a discussion with Andrew Sullivan at George Washington, in which he was being provocative, was saying...
Who's Andrew Sullivan, Scott?
Andrew Sullivan, the Daily Dish, former editor of the New Republic. And he was making the case very aggressively that there's no case to be made for continuing the CIA. You know, they have basically missed the boat on every single major intelligence analysis task that's given to them, and their operational side is a fiasco and huge embarrassment. So he's basically picking up the argument that Daniel Patrick Moynihan's made. And I have to say, I think that analysis is correct. I'd say certainly on the operations side, they have made a hash of things. It's hard to argue sustaining that. On the other hand, I would say no major country can operate without having an intelligence analysis side, so that probably is needed. But the quality of their work is pathetic, and the proposal that is now being brought forward by John Brennan is, I was just aghast when I read it. You know, he basically says the Counterterrorism Center, the CTC, is the model of, you know, the perfect, well-honed operations center for the CIA. He'd like to model everything on it. Well, if you've read the Senate Committee report, that's the epicenter of everything that was wrong with the agency and the agency's activity. All the mistakes, all the errors, all the violations of policy, all came out of the CTC. So now that's going to be the model for the entire agency. Frightening.
I remember Kennedy was so disgusted with the CIA. He said he'd like to tear it up into 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the wind. And that was 50 years ago.
Of course, Scott, they've given the CIA more operational authority rather than less. I mean, the idea that the CIA is operating part of the drone program?
Yeah.
I think much more. And, of course, President Kennedy also complained to the editor-in-chief of the New York Times that they didn't spill the beans on the Bay of Pigs operation. He said, you would have saved me and the country a big headache had you just exposed this idiotic plan. So, yeah, I think another good argument about why, you know, timely leaks are a good thing frequently.
Scott, one of the things that interested me in particular in the book was your discussion of Libya and Syria, and Libya in particular, because I brought, like, with the Center for Constitutional Rights, 20 cases challenging presidents' war power from Vietnam forward. We brought them at the center, lost almost everyone completely, even after the War Powers Resolution, was astounded that we went to war in Libya and that there was an opinion given by legal counsel for the State Department that it was legal to do so without Congress. And you make some comments about both those wars. Can you just explain how we wound up in those situations?
Right. I'd say, you know, looking at a lot of the conflicts we got involved with over the last 10 years, there's a special place of shame for the Libya conflict. And in fact, it sort of sums up how you do everything wrong, beginning to end. So what we had in Libya, we had senior staffers in the White House, including the National Security Advisor, telling reporters on background so that their names never came out. The president has made a decision. We're not going into Libya. We're keeping out of it. If the UK and France want to do something, fine, that's on them. We're not going to become involved. Within 24 hours, that was flipped around completely. Suddenly the U.S. was going into Libya and was committing, drones, Air Force, all sorts of other equipment and covert actions, going in a very, very big way. And this happens, I'd say, again, it's like 24 hours after the Secretary of Defense appeared on Capitol Hill saying intervention of the sort that the U.K. and France were advocating would be an act of war. So there's no way you could say it's less than war. And also said that there's no way you could say the security interests of the United States are implicated. So, you know, his own Secretary of Defense gave that testimony before Congress. Then they flip around and they go in. There's no public discussion. There's no presentation to Congress. There's no Oval Office speech. The White House view is we frankly don't want people even talking about this. And then you have an after-the-fact OLC opinion. Let's take that one first. The most revealing thing about the OLC opinion is its date, which is April 1st. That's an absolutely appropriate date. You know, it then goes on to say that, well, there's no real risk of Americans being killed in this engagement, so the public really doesn't have any interest in this or right to say it. Actually says that, you know, completely ridiculous statement. It then also says that there's a grave national security threat to the United States because Libyans may try to immigrate to Italy. You try and parse that. That's a grave national security threat to the United States. And it says that, you know, this would not constitute an act of war, notwithstanding the fact that the Secretary of Defense said just the opposite a day before the intervention. And obviously it would constitute an act of war under traditional analysis. So this was a completely ridiculous opinion. One of the worst that's come out of the OLC after the torture memoranda, I'd say. And then, of course, we had Harold Hong Ju Ko, someone I admire tremendously, going before Congress and backing up this opinion and saying that the activities in Libya were not just not war, they weren't even hostility, something that nobody accepted in Congress and nobody should accept. So I just say all of this was done in order to shore up unilateral power and the president to wage war overseas.
Scott, we could really talk to you forever about this, but we're running out of time. Your new book, Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare by Nation Books, is a must-read for all of our listeners, and we're so thrilled to have you on.
It's a great pleasure to be with you, as always.
Thank you, Scott.
Keep causing trouble, Scott.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
In a continuation of its decade-long effort to overthrow the Venezuelan government, the United States issued new sanctions against Venezuelan government officials who the United States claims are involved in violating human rights guarantees. President Barack Obama issued an order declaring a national emergency with respect to Venezuela. The order lists certain key Venezuelan officials and said that any financial transactions with those officials are barred. This is typical of what the United States does to officials of governments it doesn't like, whether it was Nicaragua in the 80s or Cuba since 1959 or 1960. These sanctions must also be seen in the light of the short-lived 2002 military coup in Venezuela, in which the United States was deeply involved. Today, we want to talk about the broader context of these actions and why the U.S. is continually trying to destabilize Venezuela. We're joined today by Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He writes a weekly column for The Guardian Unlimited and a regular column on economic and policy issues that is distributed to over 550 newspapers. Mark Weisbrot, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Mark, I'm just reading your article, Obama Channels Ronald Reagan, How to Create an, quote, Extraordinary National Security Threat. And it's about Venezuela. We're coming off of just recently the president's declaration that there's a national emergency with respect to Venezuela, at least in the United States. Let's start at the beginning. What is going on here?
Well, it is pretty crazy, isn't it? I mean, they have to declare that Venezuela is an extraordinary threat, unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security of the United States, and a national emergency for us. Yeah, and it's hard to really even imagine what it could be. And probably, as crazy as that is, you don't see any of the reporters asking the White House, what are you talking about? You know, after they're through rolling on the floor laughing, you think they would get up and ask them a question. But everybody just kind of passes over it. And, of course, the rest of the hemisphere doesn't see it that way. And that's another thing that's not being reported. If you look at the community of Latin American and Caribbean states, for example, that's the alternative to the Organization of American States that was created a few years ago, that in response to, you know, unpleasant U.S. actions in the hemisphere. That's every country in the hemisphere other than the U.S. and Canada. They say they reiterate their strong repudiation of the application of universal coercive measures that are contrary to international law. That was their statement on February 11th in response to the sanctions in December. So they'll respond to these as well, and probably even more strongly. You had some very strong, and of course you've had a strong statement from UNASUR, the Union of South American Nations, and you had individual statements from governments, Evo Morales of Bolivia, for example, a very strong statement saying that he wants his foreign minister to call an emergency meeting of the community of Latin American Caribbean states and UNASUR to fight this offensive that has been launched by the United States.
Let me back you up for a second, Mark, on this, because I'm interested in two things right now. What are the sanctions that were just imposed? And they're based on prior sanctions, or at least some act that Congress passed as well. So what are we talking about? What are they doing to Venezuela? And then tell us why, in their view, they're doing it.
Well, the sanctions are, this particular sanction, set of sanctions is against seven individuals who they claim are involved in human rights abuses, and it provides for restrictions on them. They can't travel to the United States. Their assets, if they have any in the United States, could be frozen. And that's most of it. I think, you know, it's not going to have much impact directly, but it's an attempt to delegitimize the government and to help the opposition. Now, they say it's, you know, human rights. And this is another thing that nobody in the hemisphere believes or even takes seriously. You had, between 2000 and 2010, the Colombian military executed over 5,700 innocent civilians, murdered them. And the United States just gave them more military aid. Currently in Honduras, you have extrajudicial executions by the security forces and the United States security aid there, too. So nothing remotely comparable to these crimes has occurred in Venezuela. So everybody sees this as completely politically motivated.
The story that's being spun principally last week on the front page of the New York Times is a full-page story. Was that Venezuela is in crisis, that there are food shortages, that there's huge demonstrations, that the place is on the verge of blowing up. And you were recently in Venezuela. How do you contrast what the New York Times reports and what you saw?
Well, you know, I was there during the protest a year ago. And, of course, it was very different from what I saw here. I was actually kind of shocked, you know. I walked all over and took the metro and everywhere and, you know, all over the city, all of Caracas. And the only demonstrations you saw were these little uprisings in the richest neighborhoods in Altamira and Palos Grandes. It was really confined to the richest part of the city. And this is something because, obviously, they're serious. There are economic problems. This last year, inflation was 68%, and you have the GDP shrank for the first time since the 2009 and 2010 recession by 3%, and you have these shortages. But the people most affected by the shortage are the ones who actually have to go and wait in line because they can't afford to buy anything in the black market. They're not in the streets. Those are the poor and the working people. So they haven't protested because they mostly support the government. And that's there's a little bit of a disconnect from what you see in the press. There's more than a little bit of a disconnect. But this idea that the protests are directly related to the shortages doesn't hold up when you see who's actually protesting. These people have servants who do their shopping, wait in the lines. And I'm talking about not the richest people either, the upper middle class. They have servants. They have storage space. And there's also recent surveys showing that people, their situation isn't as bad as what the shortages would indicate because they do stock up on things. Shortages aren't always the same goods. And so, yeah, it is definitely hard times, but it's not quite, if you go there, you really don't see this horrible situation that is described in the press. It really doesn't look that anywhere near as bad as that.
We're speaking with Mark Weisbrot of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and we're speaking about Venezuela. Mark, why is the United States so after Venezuela? How are they selling us? What are they telling us Venezuela is going to do to us, even if it's not true? What are they saying?
Well, they don't try to defend the idea of the extraordinary threat. I think they might have said something like, you have to have this language in order to impose the sanctions. But that's really not much of a defense. I mean, that's like saying, the rule of law is something that you flush down the toilet when it gets in the way of what you want to do. I mean, that law is there for a reason. Sanctions, and you probably know more about this than I do, but these sanctions are probably illegal under international law and the WTO as well, without having that excuse that the United States had to do this. You're not allowed to, for its national security, you're not allowed to impose sanctions on country just because you don't like their government.
What are they saying to the American people about why don't we like Venezuela?
I mean, again, it doesn't compare anything to Colombia or Honduras or Mexico or the countries that the United States is pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into military and police aid. But you did have 43 people killed in the demonstrations last year. Now, these were violent demonstrations, but about half of the people killed were actually killed by the protesters themselves, including a number of National Guard and police. And the people who did commit abuses or accuse them, they were arrested and put in jail. And unfortunately, the judicial system is dysfunctional there, that most of them are still sitting there. They should have had trials by now. But you had abuses, but the government cracked down on those abuses. And it's really a distortion to say, as the media does, that the government is trying to repress the opposition. The opposition still has probably most of the media in terms of audience, even though the government has several TV stations. They have a very small audience, combined audience somewhere around 8% share. And so opposition still says whatever they want. They're not afraid to say whatever they want. You do have one of the leaders of opposition, Leopoldo Lopez, is in jail. I would say he should have been released quite a while. He's been there for a year. He should have been brought to trial. He was arrested for his role in the demonstrations that were aimed at overthrowing the government. You have the recent arrest of the mayor of Caracas, Ledesma. There actually is some evidence against him. And again, if they have a trial, I think it is legitimate if they actually have enough evidence. The evidence against him is he's linked to somebody who was involved in violent action. And so, again, there are things that are questionable, things that I would never try to defend. But to create this picture, very exaggerated picture that's created here in the media, because the U.S. wants to overthrow the government there, I think is very unfortunate.
Let's cut to the chase here, because the real question is, Why does the United States want to overthrow that government? Who does that government act in favor of? And then secondly, I wanted to ask you about the connection between Venezuela and Cuba, another government that the United States has consistently wanted to overthrow.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a very long story in Latin America. The United States has tried to get rid of, you know, almost every independent, certainly independent left government for, you know, the last century. And there's been a big sea change in the region in the last 15 years. South America in particular and some other countries have become more independent than they've ever been of the United States, and more independent than Europe is. This is, and Venezuela played a huge role in that process, the creation of UNASUR, the Union of South American, the creation of the CELAC, which I mentioned. And they, so they've made major institutional changes where even the conservative governments, the ones that are still have good relations, like Colombia with the United States, the president of Colombia said at the last summit of the Americas, there's not going to be another summit without Cuba. So the whole hemisphere is united on certain questions, and questions of national independence and sovereignty, especially like they never have been before, and they have an independent foreign policy from the United States. And so Venezuela is going to be, has been a target of the United States for regime change for at least 13 years. The U.S. was involved in the coup of 2002. There's a whole stack of documents from the U.S. government that indicate and show that, even though it's never mentioned here in the press. So why is it? Well, they have the largest oil reserves in the world, and so they're going to be a regional player, at least until, you know, renewable energy replaces oil in the world. And so they don't want a government that they don't control, controlling those reserves and spreading their foul contagion in the region is the way they see it. And I think it's pretty simple, and it's pretty traditional for U.S. foreign policy. And President Obama, despite, you know, some significant changes in foreign policy, for example, his engagement with Iran, has not changed Latin America policy at all from the Bush administration, and that's why he's even more isolated in the region than Bush is.
Mark, what do you think? What do you think the chances of the American government overthrowing the Venezuelan government are?
I don't think they're very good because, first of all, you have a huge base of support in Venezuela for the government still. You know, you have like 35% or so that's going to support them. You have to remember that in spite of the shortages, the inflation, and all the economic problems, which just really have been only the last 2 years, if you take the 2003 or 2004, if you want to not take it from the recession, through the present, I mean, the vast majority of the country is still much better off than they were before. And, of course, in the pre-Chavez era, inflation was even higher, and the economy shrank for 20 years from 1978 to 98. So, you know, a lot of people know that if the opposition gets power, it's just going to get worse for them. And they also are hoping the government will fix the current economic problems, which they do have the capability to do if they wanted to do it, or if they were politically able to do it, I should say, or felt politically willing to do it. So I think that's the situation, and that's why I don't see this government being overthrown. I mean, even if they lose the parliamentary elections in December, they would still have the presidency. And then there, you know, it would be a fight to, they would have a lot of political fighting, but I don't see them being knocked out, to tell you the truth. They have $70 billion in either reserves or assets that they could sell for cash. That's like, you know, 1.75 years of import. So they're not facing a real balance of payments crisis, you know, where they can't pay for their import. They just have a dysfunctional exchange rate system, and they have a fair amount of sabotage too, but the exchange rate system is, you know, is not viable. They're giving away 70% of their foreign exchange at probably at 6.3 bolivares fuertes, domestic currency per dollar, and most of the rest at 12. that's completely unrealistic exchange rate.
Mark, one last question for you, because we're running out of time. But we're all interested, of course, in the new developments with respect to the United States and Cuba, the diplomatic relations and the move towards normalizing some of the relations. But nevertheless, the blockade of Cuba still stands. Obama could do a lot to gut it, but he won't. And the Cubans remain in the sights of the United States for a regime change. And one of their allies historically has been Venezuela. And do you think that Venezuela will still stand by Cuba with this renewed American pressure?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the statement from Fidel Castro was one of the strongest yesterday against the sanctions. And Venezuela's relations with all of the left-of-center governments in South America, too, are still very strong. Brazil, Argentina, Ecuador, Bolivia, Uruguay. So all of these countries will support them. And that's another reason I think they won't get rid of Maduro. They have very strong support throughout the region. In fact, I would even make a prediction. I would say that these sanctions are so outrageous and so over the top and so completely hated in the region that I think the White House is going to have to back down like they did in April of 2013 when the U.S. was the only government in the world that refused to recognize the Venezuelan presidential election, of which there was no doubt about the result. And, you know, at first they had Insulza from the OAS, the Secretary General, and they had the Popular Party of Spain. And then, you know, South America put so much pressure on that they had to withdraw, and the U.S. was completely isolated. And now they don't even have Insulza. They have nobody on their side, and they're going to have to back off because, you know, this opening to Cuba is a historic thing in symbolic ways. But this... the sanctions against Venezuela really negated completely for the region. That is how the governments are looking at it. And, you know, people don't see this because the press is so awful that you don't even know. You don't even know what these, in the U.S., you don't even know what any of these governments
are. Because the reality is, and we're going to close on this observation, that the United States tried to isolate Cuba. And in fact, what's happened is that the United States has become isolated. Che Guevara called the OAS the Ministry of Colonies, and it's no longer that. It's just the opposite. And now the United States is hoping to get into an OAS meeting and has to change its relations with Cuba to do it. Anyway, Mark, you've really shined a lot of light on this situation. We thank you for being a guest on Law and Disorder, and we look forward to talking to you in the future.
Thanks. It's great to be on your show.
And I recommend people to visit the website for the Center for Economic and Policy Research. It's at cepr.net, and read more of these extraordinary articles by Mark and others at the center.
Thank you, Mark.
Sure, thank you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.